I'll get to there at the end of the talk. Can anyone hear me? Yeah, okay. So right now, most of the reflections that I'm offering today are based on my experience teaching a class called Mixing and Remixing Information. We're about one-third of the way through the course right now. There's 29 classes, and we've had 8 sessions so far. And I put a URL here to a course description that I have up there. Now the goal of this class is really to introduce students to how you can use XML and web services to remix personal information. And when I first thought about this class, I made a huge list of different topics, but I finally concluded that we wouldn't be able to get through all those topics. Now, I will throw up that list of topics later on in this talk, just to give you a sense of, I think, some of the issues that are really involved in mixing and remixing personal information. But when it comes to like learning a subject like this, I think I came up with a framework that I wanted to apply in this class. Namely, that instead of learning something, none of this is rocket science, let me preface that. My remarks of that. But I thought instead of trying to learn too many things at a shallow level, well, you should learn something specific deeply and then take what you learn deeply and apply it elsewhere. So even though remix, of course, by its very nature is about bringing a lot of things, different things together, I thought, well, you're not going to be able to bring things together if you don't understand a specific thing well. So the approach is basically, first, learn an application really well. Second, when you learn an application really well, I'm meaning learning it as an end user. Before you even try to hack it, look at how the data structures work, etc. After you learn an application well, then you learn how to use the APIs that are offered up. And then finally, after you've done all that, then you're ready to look at other applications. And so I also believe very much in project-based learning because I feel that if students aren't working on things that they care about, then nothing's going to really sink in. The specific example I ended up deciding to use is Flickr. Now, probably everyone, or almost everyone in this room knows what Flickr is about. I decided to use Flickr for a number of reasons. One is that it's a very interesting application in its own right. Secondly, it has a really great API that's well documented, that has a lot of techie features. And Flickr is in many ways a poster child of the Web 2.0 phenomenon. Even as an application in its own right, without looking at the API, there are things like RSS feeds and tagging, which you can use to pull out information and put it in a different context. And not to mention that the Flickr Hacks book, a book that describes how to hack Flickr, is in print and is just about to come out. If you were at the Flickr birthday party last Saturday, you could have picked up your own free copy of that book. And I just want to give you a specific example of this kind of Flickr mashup that I use in my class to illustrate what I'm talking about. Okay, so the specific example I'm going to show you is a Grease Monkey script that runs in the Firefox browser to do geotagging. What you see here, this is a picture of Dan Chudnov from yesterday. And those of you who are familiar with Flickr might notice that there's an extra button here. So you hit the GMAP button, and what comes up is a Google map of where this picture was taken. And on top of that, you can, hit the fly to button. And what that should do is load this picture up and send send you on Google Earth to that exact location. So I think when I show this in class, I have the aim of trying to wow people. Maybe this is a much harder crowd, but.
Wow,
thank you. So I show you this as an example of the types of remixes, mashups that are happening out on the web. I didn't write this, but it's actually quite interesting. And it kind of shows a specific example of how Flickr is being used to not only store images, but also to kind of place images on a specific, at a place on a map. And then this gives an opportunity, first of all, to kind of experience the power of a mashup, but then gives an opportunity for students to really reflect on, well, actually, how does this work? Like, what part of the Flickr API is being used? How does one change what's happening in a browser? How do you connect, like how do you actually put a picture on a Google map? How do you embed it into the browser? How do you send that information to Google Earth? And those are the types of questions that come up by just studying this one specific example. And my contention is that if you learn how that actually works, and then how you can adapt it for your own needs, that gives you some type of practical insight into this whole remix area. So right now, just a bit of a word of, we're just one third through the course, and in many ways it's too early. I mean, the story's still being written, so I can't tell you how the story ends, how well this class will actually work. I've been surprised by how hard it's actually been to really figure out how to teach this material. You know, most of the thinking I've been doing has not been about the material per se. It's because that's material that I know pretty well, and I think about, for the last 5 years. And but it's been really, how do you actually organize this? How do you actually do you do some things in depth? How do you work with a diverse audience when you have students who've been writing kind of these mashups themselves on the one hand, and then you have students who didn't know what a weblog is. And plenty of students who tell you they know how to program, but when you actually push them on that, they don't really know how to program. And so that's been part of the struggle that I've been finding. I think we've put a lot of emphasis on doing project-oriented work. And that's actually been very interesting because I've been asking the students to really think about examples of remixes that they would be interested in building. And that's asked them to really reflect on things that they know and things that they're interested in. And then the final point I wanted to say is that it's very similar to the issue we have here as a speaker. When I'm in my class, most of the students have their heads buried behind their notebook computer. And I understand how it works because I was sitting over there, my face buried behind notebook computer too. So I don't really know the answer to that, because sometimes it's a struggle to, when you're talking and one is looking for feedback to know, are people getting it? And people are looking at their computer screens. And I don't have access to the IRC channel, too, at the same time. So I've toyed with the idea of, well, setting up a class IRC channel and having people essentially talk back to me in real time. And that's been done in some classrooms. But I think there's always a need for a back channel, which the speaker doesn't have access to, so you can really let your hair down so I'm up for that too. Now, I'm sorry about this slide. The next two slides are more for your reference if you want to come back to this. I wanted to just speak briefly about the subject matter itself and what type of topics actually need to go into a curriculum for this whole area. And the way I thought about here and what I have in the next two slides are a proposal I just written for the O'Reilly Open Source Conference, where I'm proposing to do a three-hour tutorial on remixing personal information. And the way I conceptualize is like, well, what would I say if I can talk to an experienced audience for 3 hours? And so an audience where I can say SOAP, WSDL, Grease Monkey, XML, and not have to explain myself or take the time to do that. Given that framework, I still figured that, well, it's kind of like teaching the class, except I only have 3 hours, and I'm not doing any projects, and I'm not assigning anything. So the themes would still be XML and web services, and I'd still use Flickr as the example to really ground my discussion. I think the way I think about this topic is so grounded in what I've learned in building the Scholar's Box, which is really about bringing together a lot of different sources of information and using web services in a practical way. Now, I listed a number of things that I try to cover, everything from, you know, a quick explanation of RSS and Atom to how would you write a service so that you can pull together, use Google Maps or Yahoo Maps or the Microsoft Maps and pull any of them out. I'd like to be able to explain in, you know, 30 seconds, a minute or two, how to do that, and how XML can be used in OpenOffice, et cetera. So those are types of things that I'd want to be able to talk about. Now, the question that I hope that we can talk about now is how do we bring library-oriented examples? Now, when I create this class, I really wanted to use a lot of library-oriented examples because that's an area that I care a lot about. But instead, I end up talking about things like Flickr, Amazon, Yahoo, you know, stuff that, you know, is interesting, but not really close to what I really care about. And so that's the question I want to pose to this audience. Like, how do I work in the library-oriented examples? And specifically, if we were to teach this in library schools. Now, the School of Information in Berkeley used to be a library school. It's no longer a library school. But if you were trying to train future librarians to think how to think about this topic, what are the questions and issues that you'd want to bring up? So I'd like to close with just that type of discussion. Okay. I've learned as a teacher that I can stand here and wait and let people think, use up my time.
It looks like you answered your own question.
I think those are some of the things I would want to talk about and have wanted to talk about.
Well, I mean, I guess the point, though, is that he has answered those questions. Where can he find that stuff? You know, he can grab this stuff from Flickr now. Where are the coins implementations? Right. Where are the UNAPI implementations?
I reckon if you look at Ann Arbor, I think it's the Ann Arbor Digital or District Library, or they've taken their catalog and put an XML interface around it, kind of a RESTful.
No, I haven't. So that.
So that's a. I know that there's a lot of people talking about it, and that might be an example of one, you know, an interface for a catalog that could be changed. Also, the SRU server at Library Congress could be a good one to use.
Yeah.
I was going to suggest that, too. We've got the SRI that we expose via SRU, so you can dump that sort of stuff. We did that in an application.
Okay.
And the SRW stuff means that you can bring up these SRI research panes too in a Microsoft environment, which is a nice reuse.
And the SRU page has somewhere has a list of implementations, doesn't it?
So, yes. Hardly comprehensive.
Right, but yeah. It's more potential targets.
Yeah. I think I missed, I have to say that I feel as though I've missed an important opportunity already in the course to give interesting library-oriented examples, because I've already steered them towards kind of the sexy stuff like I tried to show you. And
well, they can try to make our stuff sexy.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yes.
I think open search would be an example. There are several library systems, including ours, and probably the people that sort of support open search. It's kind of self-documenting too, so you can go, it's got a description document that you can look at to know what the syntax is for.
Okay.
And search various catalogs.
Okay.
And yeah. C3950 hooked to our catalog through the Microsoft Office Research Panel.
Okay.
And I didn't really get any good feedback from anybody finding it useful. I guess everybody was just kind of set their ways.
Yeah.
Has anybody else done anything with Microsoft Research Panel?
Yeah, I've had a school information sim student work with me. I had her implement a Melville search through the Office, Microsoft Office research panel. And she actually did a survey. She went and asked a few people what they thought about it. And I think it was a kind of mixed result. Some people thought it was kind of interesting. Other people thought the whole Office research panel is gimmicky. And,
right. And it's the wow factor. Like, at first you might think it's kind of neat because it's the wow factor, but
yeah.
I don't think anybody really had an interest in using it.
Yeah.
But it was the also good to use stuff research panel. Sorry. Maybe actually it's going to become a service for Campbell.
So you found people who were interested in using
it? Yes, I have been really involved in the panel and made it out to some Campbell messages. I guess it's out of this field.
Am I out of time? I think I'm out of time. Yeah. Maybe time for a few. Yes.
Looking at your Google for zooming in, how about walk-ins in the library, some kind of thing where you could geospatially show where a book is, like maybe a picture of the stacks or something, instead of just a textual thing that says, you know, level A or something. You know,
I thought I saw an example of someone showing where their branch libraries were based on. That's not what you're talking about, is are you? Like, based on something like that.
Branch libraries
done with
lots of people.
Yeah. Okay.
Getting inside the library is more so.
That's. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. For people that find most of the GTS,
Yeah. Depends on the size of your system.
Thank you very much.
Devin Smith with OCLC Research. As soon as we get this up here, I'm going to start talking about metadata translation. Here we go. I'm the code monkey. Gene Godby is the project lead. Eric Childress has been consulting with us. This is the confusion of tongues. And this was picked on intentionally because I sort of Tarantino'd my original presentation and made it non-linear. So you're going to be a little confused early on, but I hope that, you know, confusion will fuel curiosity and that I'll fill in the gaps as we go. So starting at the end, this is a metaphorical view of the model we're using. You start with your content in its container. In the first step, you change the shape of the container, but to keep the content the same. The next step, you change the content, but you only change the presentation of the content, not the meaning of the content. Then you do another presentation change, and then finally, a shape change to get your final record. So you go from the input to the output through these several steps. These are the tools we're using to do translation. At the bottom, we have something called the record object model, which is analogous to the document object model. And we have something called ROM path, analogous to XPath. And then SEAL, semantic equivalence expression language, which is analogous to XSLT. Now I'm going to go back to the beginning of the story. There are lots of schemas. There's the whole subset that is MARC. There's ONIX. There's RSS and the syndication formats. And there's just lots of these. There are different versions of some of these. ONIX has, I think, 5 major / minor version changes. And there's something called GEM, which has several changes. There's just lots of different versions. And then different formats of data, ISO MARC versus XML MARC. And then there's spreadsheets, and then there's just plain text and other binary formats. There are non-standard extensions to your standards. dc.creator.email.affiliation. These are out there, they're being used, but they're not really standards, and you still need to account for them. And then there are application profiles, which are mixing of standard elements together in sort of locally used schemas. There's ish data, which is just people using an element slightly different than you expect it to be, but they use it consistently in that way. You know, someone may be using DC source a little differently than your standard way would be. And then there's just all the homebrew data out there, which conforms to no standard and isn't even pretending to. And so that's the world you're working in, and you want to get from one format to the next. And how do you do that? Here's sort of the worst model you could choose, which is just going from your input directly to your output without breaking the task down at all. One process does the reading of the input, translating, and then the writing of the output. This has scalability problems because if you're working, for instance, on a MARC to Dublin core mapping, you have to put the XML reader in with the MARC to Dublin core semantic mapping. And if you then want to map from ISO MARC, you have to write a whole new process and re-encode the mappings again. So what would you want in your model? What makes a model for translation good? In general, you can just say that a model that reflects what a person's going to do is going to be a pretty good start for your model. And that's just the way models go. You want the model to be intuitive for people who are doing the task. You want your model to minimize the effort you're putting into it. If you're going to be doing lots of translations, you definitely want to minimize the work you have to do in maintaining and creating. You want to maximize utility. You want to get the biggest bang for your buck. For each line of code you write, you want to be able to get a lot of throughput. Here's a more literal view of the model I showed you earlier. I'm going to run through it and then come back to it, each of the parts. The first step is a structural transformation of your input. You read in your input records and you normalize the structure into one unified structure, and you obviate the syntax so that you don't have to worry about it in the translation steps. Then you translate that record into the core here in the middle. And this is a core it's in the middle sense, not in the small sense. So this isn't Dublin core. Then you do a translation from that core out to your output semantics, and then you write your record again, your final record. Now, the first step, you know, if a person breaks the task of translating down, it generally is 3 steps. Read in the records, map the records, write the new records. We do the first step just as anyone would. You have to get that data into memory into a form you can work with, and we read it into the record object model, which we felt was better for modeling objects than the DOM, or modeling records. And that serves as a separation of the syntax of your record from the semantic translations that you're doing. And this provides significant benefits I'll get into in a minute. And then there's the two-step translation rather than a one-step that a person would do. This deviates from the reflect what a person would do concept, but it provides significant benefits. If you look at that direct model where you're going straight from the input to the output, that requires about n squared minus n effort. And I'm fudging on the math there a little. But in this model, you get 2n effort because you map something to the core and then out of the core, and then it's mapped to anything you want it to go to. So in the one hand, it's n squared minus n, and the other hand, it's 2n. That's a significant reduction. Also, when you do this, you get, from that 2n effort, you still get n squared minus n utility. Once you map something to the core, it's mapped to everything else also mapped to the core. And that's a significant gain as far as utility is concerned. When you break it up like this, you can have different people working on different parts of the task. You can have programmers working on parsing records, and you can have people who know the metadata schemes, the standards, mapping them. And you can do these in parallel. You can have assigned the right people to the right job, and you don't have to be one person doing the whole task yourself. This just summarizes what I said. You separate the syntax from the semantics so that the syntax processing can be specialized, and the semantics processing can be specialized. And this fits in with the Unix philosophy of doing one thing well. And then there's the math there again. And that's sort of just a hand-waving general magnitude of how much work you'd have to do and how much utility you get. So how many people have actually used XSLT to transform their metadata? Squish your hands, yeah. A fair number of you have used a little bit of XSLT. I'm about to tell you why that was bad. Well, you know, it's the tool you had, right? You know, so I'm going to show you a better one here in a few slides. First of all, at the bottom of that stack, you saw DOM, and DOM models documents, obviously, not records. And I'm working with records. And that's sort of a small niggling thing, but it sort of just sits in the back of my mind when I'm looking at the whole stack. Now, XSLT uses two different things to model input and output. It uses XPath to get the input nodes that it's mapping, and it uses just straight DOM, expressed as XML, to do the output. This means that reversibility is difficult. Reversibility isn't really required, but if you get it, then that 2n I mentioned earlier gets cut in half to n, which is another significant gain in utility for your effort. Because of that separation, things aren't reversible because, well, just try to imagine running HTML back through your XSLT to get the original XML. Well, that's not going to work. And XSLT isn't really maintainable in this problem space because when someone is thinking about writing semantic maps, they're thinking very atomically, and this thing equals this thing. And it's very sort of row oriented. You know, you see these crosswalks on the web all the time, and they're all set up in tables. And XSLT requires you to create a valid XML document in your output. And that sort of, from a psychological standpoint, when you're thinking about getting all of that extra XML document stuff set up, it distracts you from the task of translating. Now, you get the templates, but those are sort of, that's conventional, and I really don't consider that wonderful. Also, when you look at an XSLT map that is a semantic map, it's sort of hard to see what's being mapped from and to. You can see with the XPath, okay, I'm mapping from 245A, and it's sometimes not clear, is that going to the title? Is that going here? Just the way XSLT works. It's also not exactly queryable in a machine way. You know, just imagine putting an XSLT script that does mapping through another one that does style to get an HTML table that has the lists of what you're mapping, just sort of a summary of it. And you could probably do that, but it sounds really tough, and it doesn't sound like something that would be reusable across all the different maps you might want to do. And XSLT isn't exactly friendly for the user. And I, you know, I put that question there. How often is the person who knows the metadata standards really well an XSLT programmer? And I've been between the person who was the expert and the XSLT, and that's not fun. When they have a table and they want you to make it XSLT, and then they make a change, and then you have to update it, and being that middleman is really tedious. And the XSLT designed for the task of translating. And yeah, all of the coders here could kludge up a solution to do translations. I did it. But if you're talking about robust and reliable systems, XSLT as a kludge isn't what you want. So if you're a serious aggregator of data, do you really want a kludge to aggregate your data? Well, OCLC doesn't. So just a whole bunch of things made us think, well, maybe we should look at some other things. And we didn't see anything else out there that was really designed for this task. So we just did an entire stack replacement, decided to replace something that was modeling documents with something that's modeling records, decided to have a path language to locate fields in the record, and then a seal, a language to express semantic equivalence between those fields. Just real quick, this is ROM. It's dirt simple. It's intended to be a container into which fielded data can be dumped. And the idea is that as many different records can be put in this container as possible. You have a set, contains more than one record. A record contains one or more fields. And a field has a name, which does exist in a namespace, but not an XML namespace, necessarily. I mean, you can use that if you want, but it doesn't have to be. A field can contain any number of subfields and or a value, and the value has these things. And when I was looking through all the various kinds of records out there, all the ones that I could get my hands on quickly, none of them really deviated from this model too far. So it seems like it's pretty good, but you know, I'm not married to it. If something better comes along, that's fine. Now here we have seal and ROM path, which sort of go together. A ROM path is just, it's like XPath. You work your way in steps down the hierarchy, but you query the ROM model rather than the DOM model. And seal, very simply, and clearly equates these. On the, you know, you have on the one side, this is the source, on the other side, this is the target, and it's a very obvious equation. The way I set seal up was to make it reversible. Because ROM path can be used to create and select fields from a record, it's very easily reversible. One model for locating fields is used both ways. Seal, you know, from the beginning, I wanted it to be maintainable because I was writing the seal scripts originally, and making the scripts atomic, or each map atomic, really aided in that, because you can look at one map and concentrate on what you're mapping and how that works, and it's easy for someone new, after they get a look at it, to see what's being mapped. And because of the regular structure I've created, it's very queryable. Is that a word? Did I just make that up?
Words.
I hope that's how it's spelled, regardless. It's queryable, so you can very easily, if you wanted to, create an HTML page. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, I started on an XSLT script to push seal scripts through to create a simple HTML table. And I can see an AJAX interface being built that would have a nice interface using XSLT and the whole AJAX thing to actually create and maintain seal scripts. As I said, they're atomic, so you can recombine all different kinds of maps into sort of application profile translations. So someone brings together some Dublin Core and maybe some Onyx fields. Well, you can bring together your Dublin Core and your Onyx maps into one translation. They're also cascading in the very same way that CSS is cascading. You can import your Dublin Core map and override just the DC source map so that when you have that weird-ish data, you can use all the standard elements in your standard translation and override just the weird ones. So that's SEAL in a nutshell. Here's an example. I don't know if you guys could make that out, but this is two different maps, and I want to emphasize that a map is very, very much akin to a crosswalk row. In the first one, we're mapping something that's a gem, that's the gateway to educational material. There's a typo in there. Mapping gem beneficiary to mark 521A, and it puts, you know, sets an indicator on the side. I don't know if you can see back there, but there's context information, which is just that. It's context, which makes the equation true. And then you have another one that maps DC mediator to the same field, sets some similar context things. So this is real. It's being used. I'm not just talking about vaporware. It's being used in production. They've tested out the tools, and now they're moving forward considering the full two translation step model. And we're continuing to work on the ROM implementation, the ROM path implementation, adding features to SEAL. There's the project page, although that's a little outdated. You have much better information in the presentation. This is the Tower of Babel, obviously, but it's also the name of the painting. It's really, you know, the name of the presentation was Chasing Babel, and that means we're chasing interoperability, the ability to work together with our data. And we're still chasing Babel. These tools I've developed don't get us right there with the tower up and we're all happy, but, you know, instead of crawling, now we're walking. Or we will be when everyone starts using this. And I've got a thing for the breakout for crosswalking, and I can talk about all sorts of stuff, and other people can talk about what they're doing and what they want from translation tools. And that's it. Thank you. Are there any questions real quick? One? It's not open source, but we've been having that discussion, and we think there will be parts of it that will be available, but we're not sure when yet. So, sorry.
Okay, first of all, just the picture is me trying to code, just so we get that out of the way. That's half the time is spent doing that. When I first proposed this talk, I came up with this title for it, and unfortunately, that's not really what I'm going to talk about today. What I'm going to be talking about is this, which takes a step back and doesn't make an assumption that the future of Code for Life should be a 501c3, because that was a leap in logic, which is the kind that leads me to moments like that, because software doesn't make those same leaps as you do. So some caveats. First of all, I'm not really sure why I'm up here talking to you about this, because I'm not really the one in charge. I'm not even close. It's more likely to be Ed Summers or Dan Chudnov or some of these other folks who've been around in the Code for Life world much longer than I have. Also, some of those folks like Edward Corrado and Dan Chudnov know what it's like to actually create a 501c3. John Sarnowski from Ascarta does as well, and maybe some others of you out there know that as well. So I haven't gone through it, so I'm just going to talk in more generalities. And at the breakout, if you're interested, I'm sure Edward will be able to share some of his information about what it takes to do that. Also, as I'm not decided one way or the other what I think the future of this group should be. So I'm really just here to throw out some questions and have the group itself discuss them, not come to any decision today. I don't think that's what I'm about, but I just want us to take a look at this issue and see if there's something that might be useful. Well, clearly, Code for Life is a well-established community. It has a brand identity. This conference has cemented that, or is certainly in the process of cementing that brand identity. I also think that, you know, libraries need some imaginative leadership, and I feel like I've been looking in all the wrong places for that, like at the tops of organizations and so forth, and they don't seem to be willing to take the lead. So I'm hoping that you folks, the folks in this room, might be able to lead by example and by working code and usable standards in a way that the library leaders don't seem to be doing. So that's another reason why I think it might be useful to look where we can go with this organization. Also, I think there's a lot of libraries out there who would actually jump into some of the software that we're developing if they saw a good source of support. If they saw that there was some sort of reasonable organization standing behind some of these applications that we're churning out. So it might be useful then to consider solidifying this group in a more formal way, rather than just being this kind of ad hoc group of coders. So you know, that's some of the reasons why I'm thinking about this. So far, Code for Live has been a lot of things, a mailing list, a chat room, a conference. Some would say a way of life, but hey, you know, it's supposedly you have spouses and friends and so forth that exist outside of the Code for Live world. Well, except for Ed, probably, but. So what it could be, well, I'm sorry, it looks much better on my screen than it looks up here, but anyway, is everything it already is now, plus possibly some other things. It could possibly be a real library software organization that does create these applications that libraries can depend upon, and then also provide support for those applications, support that could be bought as you buy support from your commercial company or an outfit like LibLine. It could be an employer. Some of you out there, you know, churning these things out on your own time or on your library's time could conceivably be employed by an organization like Code for Live. And then whatever else you can think of. There might be some other things that you might think that such an organization could take on. Now, part of the reasons why I'm not going to really be I'm not going to really talk about, okay, we really need to be a 501c3, is because there are fundamental questions that have to precede any such decision or even a discussion. And some of those fundamental questions are, what is Code for Live? You know, what do we want it to be? And who decides and how? You know, these are questions I don't really have the answer to. I'm hoping that some of you have those answers. I think the group really kind of needs to discuss this and come to some sort of consensus as to what it might want. Some options, these are a few, 501c3 nonprofit, a private corporation, a pile of other options and flavors of options, and then of course status quo, that is no change at all. First of all, 501c3, what is this thing? It's a tax-exempt nonprofit corporation. It has these kind of characteristics. Your assets must be dedicated to charitable purposes. Social activities must be insubstantial. No political activity. There are some benefits. Donations are tax-deductible. You're eligible for low-cost bulk mailing permit. You know, there's things like that. And you must generate, you know, public support. some benefits of being a 501c3. One of the big ones for an organization like this would be that we could actually receive grants. So we could go to, you know, Mellon, you know, IMLS or whatever, and possibly be able to get a grant to do something really interesting to help libraries move forward. Protection from personal liability, I like that one. That works for me. That's a nice plus. Some drawbacks, and those of you who've gone through this process know what I'm talking about, is enough paperwork to choke a horse. Since you will be tax exempt as an organization, the IRS looks at you extremely closely, and they just don't grant these things willy-nilly. And that also means that there are regular reporting requirements. You don't just go through the paperwork once, you go through it on a regular basis to report to the IRS on various things. And then of course no one's going to get rich, you know, this is a nonprofit. It doesn't mean you can't bring money in, but if that money just goes into your work, okay, it doesn't like accrue to an individual. So Dan's plans for early retirement wouldn't come true with this particular scenario. For a private corporation, well, a legally incorporated organization for the purpose of making profit, it's an independent legal entity. One of the benefits of this is that if the officers of the organization die or go away or whatever, the entity remains. So it's not linked to any individuals, as are some other types of corporations, such as a limited partnership or other kinds of things which are more individual based. Some benefits, well, people could get rich, potentially. There's more flexibility in terms of what you're able to do. You can get politically involved, you can do all kinds of stuff that you can't do with a 501c3. You have limited personal liability protection. There's some nuances there. What's that?
Unless you're Enron.
Unless you're Enron. Well, right. That brings it. The reason why it's limited is that you can, in fact, be found culpable of criminal acts. Yes. So that's why it's limited. But there's some initial protection there that if you're not breaking the law, you know, is okay. And then you can acquire capital through issuing stock, either to private investors or public investors. Some drawbacks, officers can be personally liable if you're out there and breaking the law. Can't receive grants, no donations, only investments. You're there to turn a profit. You have stockholders of one kind or another, private investors or public investors. And I also think that it would fundamentally kind of change the nature of the Code for Life community if you went to a corporate kind of model. Some other options. Someone brought up cooperative. I looked into that a bit. I think Ed Summers, did you mention cooperative, or who was it that?
Yeah.
Okay, then I'd need more information because I looked into that. Most of what I found, like looking into it, was farmers. So I'm not quite sure exactly how it works. So you might have examples of that.
OCLC.
OCLC.
It's a cooperative.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Then, yeah, it might be an interesting model. Partnerships, that's kind of a nuance of a corporation, private corporation. Limited liability companies or partnerships of various kinds. And then another option, which John Sarnowski has thrown out, is that he's already gone through the 501c3 process with Res Carta, and has suggested that, you know, we kind of join forces with that, with his organization. So there are different options that are out there besides the ones I've gone through in more detail. Status quo, the benefits of that is, well, we don't really have to do anything. We can kind of kick back and do what we've been doing so far. It seems to be working for a lot of people for a lot of purposes. We can remain informal and ad hoc while not shutting out any future changes. If we want to go more formal later, we could do that. That's fine. Again, I'm kind of not sure what I think should happen at this stage. Some drawbacks. you know, there's no entity, so we can't receive grants to do interesting things. You know, it's not an organization, the donation's not tax deductible. No real clear way to organize around common goals, although that's a bit arguable. We could, you know, conceivably just do that in a more ad hoc way. And of course, no opportunity to get rich, at least one that we have, not one that we've discovered so far. So this is what it's been, what it could possibly be. What do we do now? Possibly nothing. There is a breakout after the break where we can discuss, you know, what people think. Some eventual requirements for going forward is, I think, would be some sort of consensus about direction based upon those fundamental questions that I had up there at the beginning. And then some individuals willing to actually do some work depending upon which path we decide to take. Clearly, if we decide to incorporate as a 501c3, there's going to be a ton of paperwork, and there's going to have to be individuals assigned tasks who are willing to do that work. So what does the channel say? Yeah, okay, co-ops. Most co-ops are owned by its employees. Yeah, okay. Yeah, co-ops owned by members. Holy crap. Oh, okay. Aaron, yeah. Aaron's on TV, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, no terribly insightful comments, but so fundamental questions, what are we, what do we want to become, and are we willing to do the work to get there, and who decides and how? And I think those are some of the fundamental questions that we'll be exploring in the breakout after this, for those of you who want to participate. Questions, comments, brickbats?
Or what's Red's card?
John?
It's a really important not-for-profit corporation, and our basic foundation is to build open source software for imaging in libraries. That's where our focus comes from, but we're really trying to encourage open source software for libraries and giving it a form and a presence so that it can be supported over a long period of time. That's mostly the resistance of people to get involved is, you know, how are you going to sustain yourself? Right now you're working on two grants and some money, how are you going to sustain yourself? So what we're saying is sustain yourself by building a community, and just like Evergreen, getting people involved, getting it in, getting it up. Now you've got buy-in from the state government, getting people buying in, and then they've got interest in keeping you alive.
Yeah.
So at Emory, Martin is spearheading the creation of the Best Scholar Institute, which sounds like some of this stuff. The idea is to have a sustainable shell for digital library services on a contract or cost recovery basis. Sounds kind of like some of the stuff. I don't know if there could be some interplay. Also, there's InfoMine.
Is InfoMine a...
I think so. The cost recovery or planning would be kind of their own nonprofit.
Huh. I didn't know that.
I don't know if InfoMine actually appears as a client. We work with them just in terms of library consultants.
Dan?
Something I don't think you mentioned, but would maybe not, would be a go-to of school.
A school?
Yeah. How to get people up to speed.
Ah, right.
A lot of us have to sort of learn all this on our own.
Cool.
One of the best things that CloakRoom has done for me is to have people that are always around that I can turn to and close those gaps faster.
Well, in a way, the chat room has been really helpful that way for me, and I know others, you know, say, I got this problem, how do I fix it? And
Yeah.
Ed jumps in and fixes it for you.
Well, I mean, the model I have in mind is just very old school.
Yeah.
I don't know if Ed is really behind the scenes there too or not. That would be really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. Well, I think we're out of time, but again, there is a breakout on this if you want to talk about it more. We've got a break for, what, 15 minutes and then the breakouts?
Yes.
Great. Okay. We'll see you then.